First case is case number 9, SC252, Lewis versus the People. We're set for an hour argument. Half hour each side. Please keep track of your time. Are both counsel ready? Stay there. One thing, just for the record, please state your name at the beginning so we have that. Thank you.
May it please the court, Andrew Hare, registration number 16891, on behalf of Mr. Lewis. May it please the court, I first intend to address why sexual assault and a class 2 felony kidnapping offense, which also involves sexual assault, is an element of, and that offense, sexual assault, is an included and element of second-degree kidnapping involving sexual assault. I tend to address this from a point of view of the U.S. Supreme Court cases that have now passed upon this particular issue and given the court some additional, basically important information about how to inform it when it's deciding whether or not a fact that the state has set forth in a criminal offense is an element. States are entitled to proscribe a range of conduct. They're entitled to label those facts as they wish. They have called them aggravating factors, aggravating circumstances, penalty enhancers, and in this case, this court called sexual assault a sentence enhancer in Henderson. When facts increase the maximum possible punishment that the defendant can face, the labels give way to the Constitution. And so at that point, the Supreme Court has made clear in no uncertain terms that those sentence enhancers, aggravating factors, circumstances, what have you, become the functional equivalent of elements for constitutional purposes. And so then the Constitution begins to dictate how those particular sentence enhancers, aggravators, and circumstances are treated.
Counsel, can I stop you there? Because you used the word constitutional purposes. And I'm wondering if you can respond to the argument that the state will make, which is basically all the Supreme Court has ever talked about is the Sixth Amendment right. And that's not implicated here.
Well, I would go back to say that the Supreme Court has been consistent with respect to whether it's called an ingredient, a fact, an aggravator, a circumstance, an enhancer. The Supreme Court has been consistent, whether it's due process, trial by jury, and I think now with Justice Scalia and Sadezan, the dissent as well, and then ultimately the use of the phrase federal constitutional purposes, that they are focusing on the effect. You see that in Mulaney versus Wilbur. You see this in Ring and Apprendi, and now you see this for purposes of double jeopardy. That the court is not dictating to the state what to do, how to say it, how to define it, how to prescribe it. They are saying that if the fact has the effect of raising the maximum punishment that has that effect, then it is the functional equivalent for federal constitutional purposes of being an element. And again, whether it's due process, trial by jury, or double jeopardy. And so that's why, for federal constitutional purposes, I think that is actually the correct phrase, because that now consistently operates to describe as a consistent, broad, correct approach that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken with regard to these kinds of issues.
I follow up on that just one second about the element, the way you said element or sentence enhancement factor. Whether it's an element or a sentence enhancement factor, do you think the legislature in any state is permitted to punish that same conduct, the same elements or sentence factors, in two different places as long as they make clear they want to?
That is the gist of Missouri versus Hunter. And the caveat there for Colorado is that Colorado actually explicitly prohibits that on its face with 18-1408. That's Mr. Lewis's position. That statute actually doesn't permit that when the elements are the same included in offenses. So in Colorado, it would actually be, it would be paramount, necessary, absolutely necessary, that the legislature make explicit that 18-148 doesn't apply and that they want separate sentences for the convictions at issue when they are the same offense, same elements.
I take from the way you say that, then, that you would agree the question before us is what did the legislature intend here rather than what is constitutionally permissible?
Well, again, there's kind of a confluence, I think, between the two, because I think in Henderson, Justice Erickson started out by saying, well, we're going to look to whether or not these are the same elements, because if they're not, we don't need to get to the question of legislative authorization. So, and then also you have the constitutional analysis in terms of looking to the effect. So, yes, the legislative intent is important, but it doesn't... In this instance, where the court has held that the legislature intended these to be, intended sexual assault to be a sentence enhancer, first, I think that that analysis resulting in that conclusion is debunked by looking at Ring and Apprendi and now with Sadazan and Justice Scalia's, because for a couple of reasons. One, just the more most obvious one, is that sexual assault has the effect of raising the maximum punishment that the accused can receive in the context of Class II felony second-degree kidnapping. The second is one of the rationales in Henderson was that well, we can obtain the second-degree kidnapping conviction regardless or separate from or independent from the question of sexual assault, and so that's why sexual assault is a sentence enhancer and not an element and not part of the offense. But that rationale, really, if you look to, for example, Ring and Walt, and in the capital sentencing context especially, first-degree murder can be obtained independent of aggravating factors, but that doesn't mean that the constitutional analysis, that the for federal constitutional purposes, those aggravators or sexual assault does not still, for constitutional purposes, remain as an element. The legislature could not have intended, given Henderson, that the element sexual assault in Henderson as a state matter is a sentence enhancer, but at the same time mean that sexual assault and kidnapping are the same as sexual assault, but we legislatively authorize consecutive punishment or mandate consecutive punishment. So it's an inconsistency for the state to even suggest that somehow there's legislative authorization when that would itself be defeated by Henderson, but also because it's not expressly legislatively authorized. An example.
I'll let you go on. I just wanted to draw the last conclusion. I think you answered my question in the series, but where I was kind of going with that is to make sure that you're not suggesting that, you know, the Apprendi line of cases, Ring, any of them, in any way modify Whalen or Missouri v. Hunter.
You know, that's a good question, and one that has come up. I don't believe that the court needs to go there. I don't see that the Sadazan, Justice Scalia's view, and the inclusion of the Apprendi line of analysis with double jeopardy in terms of determining elements would require the eradication of that particular side of it. Because again, the Supreme Court's been explicit about this particular area that we're talking about punishment. So in that context, if the state wants this particular range of punishment, which includes an element in one offense and an element in another that is the same, then that just becomes the fund of punishment that's available for when those two offenses are committed. And the state has made explicit their wish to have this range of punishment imposed. So no, my answer is no. I don't think that it requires the court to do away with or eradicate that particular side of double jeopardy jurisprudence or to be concerned about it. Mr. Lewis's position is they're the same elements, and the state hasn't legislatively authorized it. So it's at an end at that point, and that double jeopardy would protect against double punishment for sexual assault in the kidnapping and then sexual assault as another offense. With respect to kind of the development of double jeopardy law, I think the court has recognized on at least a couple of occasions, one in Belize at page 1281 and note 3, and then Abedin at page 469, note 11, that double jeopardy jurisprudence has been developing, continues to develop. This is not something that's particularly earth-shattering or remarkable here, and certainly it's not earth-shattering or remarkable that the court's decision about what are elements in the context of double jeopardy would be informed by a natural connection with trial by jury and what are elements in that particular area. There's a natural connection, I believe, between, and Mr. Lewis contends, between the Apprendi and Ring line of cases deciding that an element is something that enhances or increases the maximum punishment the state asserts as a procedural requirement of a trial by jury. But the state then says, double jeopardy is not a procedural requirement. It just dictates when there's a permissible jury trial. But obviously, it would be important to know in this context and have symmetry and consistency between the two in deciding what are elements, what can be double punished, what can't be, and when a trial can be held again and when it can't be. This provides a natural, I think, and a logical symmetry between the two. And I think Justice Scalia and the dissent in Sadezan, and then later in Shiro, when they talk about federal constitutional purposes, this is the consistency that the court intends and has intended, as I explained earlier, across the spectrum of due process, trial by jury, and now double jeopardy.
Here, I'm a little, just a little confused in terms of your answer to Justice Coates on the topic of Missouri versus Hunter. Do you first look at the double jeopardy issue? Do you look at the legislative issue? I was a little confused in terms of your overall approach. What are you asking us to do first, and then how would you do it?
You look first to, in the kidnapping statute, you look to the effect of the sexual assault issue, the fact. And what does it do? What's the effect? The effect is it raises it from a Class 4 to a Class 2 felony. With changing the range of punishment.
Sure.
And so for that reason, it is an element. And so because it's an element, for federal constitutional purposes, the other sexual assault, the same sexual assault.
I understand that argument.
Okay.
But then I don't understand how you incorporate the Missouri versus Hunters into that. It seems like that is kind of avoided.
Well, I'm not avoiding it because if they are the same elements, this is just, you know, for example, Justice Erickson, if they are the same elements, then double punishment is not permitted, multiple punishments, unless there's explicit legislative authorization.
So why isn't there express legislative authorization in this case?
Several reasons. One, there would have to be, for example, in 42206, the DARP statute is an example of the legislature explicitly saying do not follow 18-1408, because once the court has established that the sexual assault is an element within kidnapping, the same and included sexual assault that is the other offense or the same offense, that is the end of it. It's included and it can't, the accused cannot be convicted of a separate sexual assault. And so because there's an explicit Colorado statute that prohibits it, the legislature would have to expressly say, as they do in 42-2206, that the provisions of that statute do not apply. And then secondly, they would have to say expressly that they intend and want multiple punishments for both the kidnapping involving sexual assault and the sexual assault. The lead says that it has to be in the statute itself. The legislature knows this. There's an example of how they did it and have done it. That's how it has to happen. So
I thought we were supposed to look at the definition of the crime as adopted by the legislature, and certainly those are two different crimes, are they not? I mean, the kidnapping with the sexual assault and the sexual assault, they're defined as two different crimes.
Well, on the face, yes, they're in two different provisions.
Right.
But the sexual assault, and in this particular case, actually, within the jury instruction itself, explicitly referred to the same charge, sexual assault.
But we often get that. That's just the same transaction, right?
I agree. I think secondary kidnapping involving sexual assault and charged sexual assault that the jury relied upon to enhance the secondary kidnapping is the same transaction. It's the same offense. It's one offense.
But we've allowed that to happen, the same set of facts and different crimes apply. I know this goes back to some of the original questions, but I don't think I'm over the hurdle yet. You're asking basically that what's the remedy you're asking for here? This is a sentencing remedy, right?
Vacating the sexual assault, the separate sexual assault convictions.
A lesser one, as what you're describing as the lesser.
A lesser or included offense.
So that they vacate them, so they have no effect on the sentence.
Correct. That's absolutely correct.
And you're doing that under the double jeopardy analysis,
double jeopardy,
basically.
18-1408 of merger principles.
But and there's no issue of Apprendi in terms of the jury trial. The jury got the case and
that's correct.
Returned the convictions.
Correct. And to get back to your point about that the statutes are different, why can't we impose separate convictions and sentences? And it's because the secondary kidnapping statute itself expressly includes sexual assault, we contend, as an element. And so it's the same sexual assault that it's charged in this particular
case. Well, it's a more dangerous crime, arguably. You know, it's
kidnapping involving sexual assault is, and that dangerousness is reflected by the legislature or recognized by the imposition or enhancement of the penalty up to 48 years from a class 4 to a class 2 with a maximum punishment.
Which under your analysis would stand, you just vacate the consecutives for the...
Correct, on the sexual assault.
Okay.
Mr. Rapp, it seems to me that you are saying that any legislative intent expressed in our understanding of this previously as a sentence enhancer can no longer be considered. Is that correct? To phrase it differently, it's like, why can't we look at the legislative intent in making this a sentence enhancer, even though it operates as an element for constitutional purposes? It nonetheless expresses a legislative intent contrary to where you would like us to go.
I agree. I think the court can maintain the label if the court wants to, if the court still maintains that the legislature intended this to be a sentence enhancer. Really, it ultimately boils down to a decision now about what that sentence enhancer is in constitutional framework, being informed by...
Why isn't it the question, instead of what is the sentence enhancer in a constitutional framework, why isn't the question instead, what did the legislature intend by making it a sentence enhancer, even if that no longer has effect for many purposes, what did it intend with respect to the appropriate sentencing?
Well, I think I'm not saying the court can't look to what the legislature intended. I think that it can consistently hold that the legislature intended to be a sentence enhancer, and it is an enhancer. Excuse me, but it is a relevant question about what does that mean, knowing what we know now with Apprendi and Sadazan and the development of this law. What does that mean? Does that mean that, is it relevant, as I earlier discussed, that you can still, it's a sentence enhancer because, and it's not an element, it's not included, because you can obtain a second-degree kidnapping conviction without the sexual assault? No, it's not. That for constitutional purposes. So ultimately, the court can maintain the label of sentence enhancer, but the federal constitutional impact is that it must be considered an element for federal constitution, effectively the functional equivalent. Now, maybe...
May I interrupt you, counsel, on that point? So essentially what you're saying, when is a sentence enhancer now ever simply a sentence enhancer? Or is your argument now that all sentence enhancers are effectively elements? Is there no such thing anymore as a sentence enhancer in light of Apprendi?
Well, I think if sentence enhancers, for example, in McMillan versus Pennsylvania, if they move up the sentence within the range already provided, that can be something that it can be qualified as a sentence enhancer. We have extraordinary risk provisions which enhance the, for example, the midpoint in the presumptive range and so forth. So it's already within the range of punishment provided. So it's not increasing the maximum punishment, but we still call them either extraordinary risk factors, extraordinary circumstances, that kind of thing. We can have aggravating factors that increase the punishment within the presumptive range or within our aggravated range to the top end. So sentence enhancers in that context can be called that, and they're not necessarily the functional equivalent of elements. They may not be for constitutional purposes. But I think one of my earlier comments, I probably wasn't that clear, is that once the court, if the court were to agree or adopt the earlier interpretation that it's a sentence enhancer, it can't at the same time be a legislative authorization, explicit, as I described, consistent with the example I've given in the briefs in 42.2.206, where the legislature says 18.148 doesn't apply because we have this, it's a little broader, it is relevant in this area, and we want consecutive punishment with respect to, you know, the DUI and the driving offense. Here would be, we want consecutive sentencing with this kidnapping and sexual assault and the sexual assault. That would be express legislative authorization. But our view or our contention is that simply calling it a sentence enhancer does not equate with those necessary.
Why? Why doesn't it equate with that? I mean, it seems to me what you're saying is it doesn't equate with that because the constitutional outlook has shifted, and constitutionally it's indistinguishable from an element. And I guess what I'm asking you to refute would be the argument that the change in the constitutional arena does not affect what the legislature intended. It may affect what they are able or not able to accomplish. It may mean that for many purposes, a sentence enhancer is constitutionally, operates as an element. But why doesn't it nonetheless express their intent, notwithstanding the fact that the limits, there may be limits to how it may operate?
Well, first, the ability to impose consecutive sentencing out of Henderson was not because the characterization as sentence enhancer did that. So my first view of that is that it would be, and so, and also consistent with Justice Erickson's analysis, is that you don't get to legislative authorization unless they're the same elements. But the court didn't get to the question of legislative authorization because it's not there. So the sentence enhancer characterization was not to inform or provide for explicit authorization for multiple punishments. It actually, because of that, because they were not the same offenses, it wasn't a concern. It didn't have to happen. And the element itself, sexual assault, did not at the same time qualify as express legislative authorization. If you look at Missouri versus Hunter, the Armed Criminal Action statute itself, this is what the Supreme Court was addressing, that particular provision. It said explicitly that conviction for this particular offense is to run consecutive to, in addition to, however you want to describe it, any other offense that included the same arm, weapon that is used and that resulted in this conviction. It was explicit. That's why this court in Boulie says it's got to be explicit in the statute and talk about consecutive punishment and talk about the inapplicability of 18.1408.
Do you think it's fair to say that line of reasoning is really an argument that Henderson was always wrong and not that it's been changed as a result of Apprendi?
That the analysis of whether it was an element or a sentence enhancer?
Analysis whether the legislature intended for both crimes to be punished.
A mistake that...
A mistake by this court. I mean, in effect, are you arguing, given the way we rationalized that or decided it in Henderson, without the kind of specificity that was shown in Missouri v. Hunter and these others, that really we should have decided it was a double jeopardy violation?
I think certainly the court could have, because if you look at Whalen, which predated Missouri versus Hunter. In Whalen, they dealt with the offenses of rape and then rape during a killing. And really, that case more closely matches Henderson and the kidnapping statute and the sexual assault statute, where there in Whalen, the Supreme Court said, there's no authorization here. I mean, we had the elements, you know, U.S. code, which basically mirror, you're just changing out characterizations of elements. It's the same thing. And yes, I agree. I think the court should have said, no, these are the same. It's included. There's nothing in here that says that the legislature wants or intends to not apply 18-1408, and that it intends explicit, you know, multiple punishments of these two offenses. I see I have about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Good morning. John Seidel, bar number 17633 for the people. There's a number of playgrounds that we could play on today. I'm going to step on the defendant's petitioner's turf for a moment and then move on to some other playgrounds. We know that Apprendi and Ring and Trudeau talked about what is necessary to sustain a punishment outside the prescribed statutory maximum. The jury has to determine facts that push sentences outside that. And we know from their text that Apprendi, Ring, and Shiro are all about Sixth Amendment and due process as it serves the Sixth Amendment jury trial right. It's in their text, and we've quoted that extensively in the brief. Other cases have recognized that those are all Sixth Amendment cases. Now, only two current United States Supreme Court justices have believed that the Apprendi rationale can be imported to Fifth Amendment double jeopardy concerns. Several courts have recognized that that view is limited to, at the time, three and now two current Supreme Court justices. We've cited those in the brief. Only one unpublished decision that's cited in the reply brief and maybe in goes the other way. This would be the first court in the nation to publish a case saying that Apprendi extends into the Fifth Amendment double jeopardy arena. And as a side note, the defendant's arguments, when it comes down to this case, the defendant's argument is that the trial court's failure to follow sua sponte, the Satizan minority of three justices, now two, and an unrelated footnote in the Satizan dissent, in a case which is totally different from what Satizan was addressing, was obvious error. So I think that, sort of by way of introduction, that's where we stand on the main issue that's been presented here. Does Apprendi mean what the defendant says it means? And the answer is clearly no. Now, there's a different playground that we can move to, and that is, well, what is double jeopardy and how does it work and how do you do the analysis? And as we set out in the brief, and I think the defendant agrees, at least to some extent, there are two parts. One is, what did the legislature authorize? And if the legislature has authorized multiple punishments for two crimes, then our analysis is at an end, as Missouri versus Hunter said. Now, in the Powell case, which was a double jeopardy case, this court said, held that kidnapping, it observed that kidnapping does not require sex assault for a conviction. Sex assault is an enhancer. And what the court said was, the legislative intent clearly authorized punishment for both kidnapping, enhanced with sexual assault, and a separate sexual assault. That was 716 P. Second at page 1105. Now, the court, I think, reached that analysis, or reached that result, by looking at the language and structure of the two statutes. And I believe Justice Hobbs and Justice Martinez have pointed out that that is how courts go about deciding what the elements of an offense are. They look to the language and structure of the statute. This court has done it in Haymaker. They've done it in Rowe, where they said heat of passion isn't an element of assault, it's a mitigator. You've done it in McKinney, where you said even though the theft from an at-risk statute is its own statute, this court said it still is just a sentence enhancer because all of the elements are referred to, are encompassed in another statute, namely the theft statute. Of course, looking at the statute's language and its structure, that's how this court has determined what's an element, and it's also how the United States Supreme Court has done it. I mean, look at Jones, which is the predecessor to Apprendi or Almendarez-Torres, where they said prior conviction is an enhancer, not an element, based on the structure of the statute. So Powell, this court said, legislative intent clearly authorized punishments for each of the kidnapping enhanced and the sexual assault. And then Henderson came along and said essentially we do the same analysis and get the same result under the doctrine of judicial merger. And in Henderson, this court recalled that in Powell, the court, it had said legislative intent clearly authorizes punishment for both enhanced kidnapping and the sexual assault. So if you look at it that way, if you look at what this court has already said, our legislature intends there to be a separate punishment. What's changed? Nothing has changed the legislature's intent. And no Supreme Court case, U.S. Supreme Court case, can go back in time and rewrite or substitute what this court has already found to be legislative intent in these two statutes. So if you look at it this way, there's no need really to reach the issue presented. All the court would have to do is say, we have said before, and we'll say it again, that the legislature clearly intended for there to be multiple punishments for kidnapping and sex assault under these facts.
Well, counsel, can I just stop you there? I think Mr. Hare argues, though, that there is no clear statement of that intention in the statute, and he draws our attention to the DUI example, and I'm wondering if you can help me there. What position do you take? How clear does that intent have to be expressed?
The DUI example in Carlson, I mean, that's nice. That's beautiful. It's you can't ask for clearer than that, but that doesn't, in my mind, that's not the minimum standard of clarity.
So simply because the legislature did it so clear in one instance does not mean that it has to do it so clearly in other instances? I mean, is that?
That's kind of where I'm going.
Okay.
There's more to it.
Okay.
What I want to say about this is that 18.1408 was, in fact, a legislative statement about the intent behind our statutes. Let me see if I can get to my notes on that point. And if you look at 18.1408, subsection 5, there's actually three ways in which an offense can be a lesser included. There's subsection A, the same or less than all of the facts required to establish one offense makes it a lesser included. An attempt or solicitation is a lesser included of the greater offense. And then in 5C, if you have the same conduct with but a lesser risk of injury, then perhaps that's a lesser included offense. And actually, Raymer, an old case from, I think, 81, is a case where this court applied that last subsection. But of course, we're here under 5A, the same or less than all the facts required. Now, you know, when the legislature enacted that statute, there were other ways that courts could consider or that the legislature could have adopted to figure out when one offense is a lesser included. There was this, they adopted the statutory elements test, but you could go by the pleading theory, you could go by the inherent relationship theory or the cognate evidence test. And in fact, this court has recognized in Leskey and in Meads that those tests were valid. And in fact, in Meads, the court said, you know, 5A, the language they used, they might have, the legislature might have meant, I mean, there's an argument to be made that they meant, let's look at the evidence and not just the statutory elements. But Leskey and Meads reaffirmed, no, what the legislature meant in 5A was you look at the statutory elements of the offenses as charged, not in the abstract, but as they're charged in a specific case. Now, let's look at 5A. 18-1-408-5A. That provision, as I understand it, codified the rule from Blockberger versus the United States in 1932 decision. Well, now, a lot of people cite Blockberger as a double jeopardy case, but it isn't a double jeopardy case. It was a rule of statutory construction, and what it said was where two offenses overlap, basically, where establishment of one offense necessarily establishes all the elements of another. We presume in that circumstance that the legislature who wrote those two statutes did not intend multiple punishments or separate punishments for each of those two offenses. But it still may be that there could be express authorization for multiple punishments, but absent a clear authorization where the two statutes meet this test, we interpret them to mean legislature didn't want dual punishments. So if 5A codified Blockberger, and Blockberger was a rule of statutory construction or a presumption, then 5A itself is a rule of statutory construction. When Henderson came along, the court looked, and admittedly it didn't look, it didn't expressly discuss 18-1-408, but this is how I read Henderson. I read Henderson as further interpreting what is already a rule of statutory construction. And Henderson said, for purposes of 5A, 18-1-408-5A, facts that only go to sentencing aren't going to be considered as elements for purposes of how we interpret the legislature's intent. So, given 5A and Henderson's interpretation, put those two together, and they together are just the first half of any double jeopardy analysis. Section 5A and Henderson, with its rule that we don't consider facts that go only to sentencing, those things together are the first half of a double jeopardy analysis. They're the things that we use to decide, does the legislature intend multiple punishments? It may be that Section 5A is borrowed from double jeopardy cases like Blockberger, but it is now a state interpretive rule about our legislature's intent, and that does not change with United States Supreme Court precedent. So the long and short of it is, Your Honor, 18-1-408-5A, and actually its other counterparts, 5B and 5C, those are statements of legislative intent. They and Henderson are the clear statements or allow us to conclude what the legislature wanted. And since, in this case, sex assault is an enhancer, it's not necessary for conviction, under state interpretive rules, we interpret that to mean that the legislature intended both punishment for the kidnapping enhanced and the sex assault.
So that would stand as case precedent unless the legislature wants to change the result of that analysis. You think that rule of statutory construction analysis is solid enough through the cases to establish that as legislative intent.
I do. Now, I will say that, and it's not so unusual for legislatures to enact rules about construction of their own statutes. There are other statutes that do that, and I don't have the site with me, but there's one that says we're not going to use the rule of the last condition antecedent. I don't have the site, I'm sorry, but I know you all have dealt with it. So this is just the legislature's way of saying, here's what we mean, here's how you determine, you know, when multiple punishments are allowed. And then Henderson came along and said, what the legislature meant when they did that, they didn't mean to include sentence enhancers, facts that aren't necessary for a conviction. Now, what's interesting about that point is that the court has consistently said, you know, double jeopardy and merger, and maybe even the statutory merger, they're all sort of analyzed the same. And what I think would be useful, it would be a statement from this court that, and this is a good case to do it, is to say, look, we really want to address 18-1408 now by itself and just say expressly, you know, this is a statement about how our statutes are to be interpreted and what the legislature intended vis-a-vis multiple punishments for multiple crimes. I think that would be useful. But the answer, short answer to your question is yes, I think that is. And if the legislature, if it's to be changed, the legislature would have to do it, or this court would have to go back and say, you know what, that's not what the legislature meant. And then come up with some other interpretation of the rule, but of Section 5A, but we don't, that's not been argued here.
But the constitutional analysis doesn't compel that.
I don't believe so, no. In fact, one of the points I wanted to make, we did make in the brief, and I think it's been discussed here, you know, if he's right, if their side is right, I think that you really are overruling Hunter, Brown, that line of United States Supreme Court cases. Those cases, as you pointed out, if the legislature wants a fact to be a sentence enhancer, and if the legislature has expressed that the sentence enhancers don't count when you're comparing offenses for double jeopardy purposes, then the United States Supreme Court isn't going to bother you. We're not going to get into that. We can't get into that. It's not our province. Now, Justice Marquez asked a minute ago, well, isn't one consequence of the defendant's analysis that sentence enhancers don't exist anymore? And I believe the answer to that is yes. Now, defense counsel said, oh, well, the legislature can still use and have sentence enhancers. If that's their intent, they can do that. But I think Justice Marquez's point is they won't function as sentence enhancers in the sense that the legislature wanted them to. Instead, they've become new offenses attached to old offenses, or they have grown out of old offenses. And Hunter and Brown say nothing from the U.S. Supreme Court can change what the legislature has designated as an offense.
Wait a minute. I mean, for some purposes, there's no question that they can call it whatever they want to call it, a sentence enhancer or anything else. And in some circumstances, it's an element, and it operates as an element of the crime. That is, obviously, for purposes of jury determination.
But I agree with that.
So the question is whether there's a limit to that, whether it is an element for all purposes or simply for some.
Let me back up. I agree that the court can say, the United States Supreme Court can say, procedurally, this is how things have to be determined, which is what they did in Apprendi and Ring. And when they said that, they were saying, for purposes of jury trial right, yes, sentence enhancers have to be treated like they are elements. They're the functional equivalent of elements. But in saying that, they, as I quoted in the brief one case, point out, they chose their language carefully. Because if they had meant to say, or if they had tried to say, sentence enhancers are elements for all purposes, such that every offense coupled with an enhancer is now its own standalone offense, even though our state legislature didn't define it as such, if that's what they had meant, then Apprendi and that line of cases would really be overruling Hunter and Brown. And yet, nowhere in any of these cases do we see even an inkling of that intent to overrule those prior cases.
I have another question I wanted to ask you, which is, forgetting about the legislative intent for a moment and your argument about not even really needing to fully address the constitutional issue, just that aside for a moment, it seems to me your argument that a sentence enhancer is constitutionally distinguishable for double jeopardy purposes seems to be based on a vote count, that is, counting the Supreme Court justices and saying the court hasn't gone that way yet. Scalia's remark is that there's no principled basis to make a distinction. Can you address that? What is the principled basis to make a distinction with regard for sentence enhancers in the double jeopardy context?
I think the principal reason is the principal reason is set out in Hunter and Brown, and we just talked about it a little more in the brief, and that is that it is the state's prerogative and in fact their duty to define offenses and the punishments therefore as they see fit. And for the United States Supreme Court to come in and say, you know what, your kidnapping with sex assault is now no longer an offense with an enhancer, it is now its own offense, that is an imposition on the state's authority, plenary, maybe I'm using the word wrong, but it's their sole authority to do that, to define crimes and offenses. It's as a sort of a corollary to that point. What does happen when and if we were to take Justice Scalia's word and believe that there's no reason why the elements shouldn't be, there's no reason that what the state defines as an enhancer shouldn't be an element? Well, let's just take that to its logical conclusion. What happens? What is the unit of prosecution in those cases? And let's just take this case as an example. He says, the defendant says, there's no dual punishment. You can't have separate punishments for kidnapping enhanced by sex assault and the sex assault, because the sex assault is included in this new yet undefined offense of kidnapping with sexual assault. What happens if there is a victim, there's a kidnapping and the kidnapping victim is sexually assaulted and robbed? Now, under our current law, it's my understanding that the sex assault and robbery are both sentence enhancers. They both bump up the felony to an F2. There's one unit of prosecution, it's the kidnapping, and then the two facts enhance the penalty. Under his theory, there are two offenses. There's a kidnapping with sexual assault, and there's kidnapping with robbery. And as I understand it, there can be two sentences, F2 sentences imposed for that crime. A similar result obtains if you have, let's say, a kidnapping and a victim who is sexually assaulted at midnight and then at 4 in the morning. Okay, now under the current statute, under the current scheme, I think, at least an argument would be made, there's only one unit of prosecution, which is the kidnapping. And then the enhancing fact occurred twice, but that doesn't give you two enhancements, nor does it give you two offenses. But under his theory, arguably now you have two units of prosecution, two kidnapping with sex assaults. Again, you have two F2 convictions, whereas now you only have one. I think this really comes down to be careful what you wish for. I think Justice Scalia wasn't, I'm not sure what he was thinking, but I do think he overlooked the problem. I think he overlooked Hunter and Brown, that talked about the state's authority and how important it is for the United States Supreme Court to defer to state definitions and state legislative intents. And I also think he overlooked the huge practical problems that obtain when some court in some far-off land says, okay, your offenses and sentence enhancers aren't what you think they are now. They're something totally different.
Do you think he was concerned with the question of multiple convictions at the same proceeding at all, or was he dealing with what is clearly a double jeopardy problem of subsequent prosecution after an acquittal?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, Satizan was a totally, largely a different double jeopardy problem to begin with. I do think he tried to go out of his way to equate or say something about all crimes in the context of a double jeopardy case that was addressed a totally different situation, which was the trial after an acquittal. And of course, the issue in Satizan there was, what is an acquittal? So the short answer to your question is, when he said that, he wasn't. I think the argument can be made that we can discount what he said there because it's a different double jeopardy problem. I think I've said what I wanted to say. If there are no more questions, thankfully, I will sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Seidel. Rebuttal?
No questions.
Mr. Hare?
Oh, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't think there were any questions. I apologize. Are there? Thank you. Mr. Hare, rebuttal.
May it please the Board. With respect to the standard of review, Mr. Lewis sets forth authorities with regard to the de novo standard of review that should be applied by this court, and that multiple convictions, multiple sentences imposed in violation of double jeopardy do qualify and do implicate the rights of the accused. Are obvious and affect the fairness and integrity of the proceedings and also the integrity of the system itself, and are subject to plain error standard of review. I think also the Blakely decision, there's a comment in the Blakely decision in defending the Apprendi analysis, and the court says it's trying to give intelligible content to the Sixth Amendment and to this particular issue. And at the same time, I believe that Justice Scalia, Satizan, the dissent, and the more general description of federal constitutional purposes, the elements, facts that increase the maximum possible punishment, are subject to both trial by jury due process and double jeopardy protections. This gives an intelligible content and a way for the court to properly assess and be informed about when it decides later issues that are similar to, different from, this particular issue in this case. I think I'm not going to readdress the Henderson and Powell and what the court was meaning there and what the sexual assault element means now after being informed. I think that I've addressed that enough.
Unless I ask you one question here. I don't want to eat up all of your rebuttal time, but I was curious, is the way you've phrased where we should go here about what the conclusion would be in terms of this particular statutory construction. Would it be your understanding then that with these words, one could not be convicted of both kidnapping and a sexual assault that was committed during the kidnapping, but rather one would automatically have to be found guilty as a class 2 felon for the kidnapping, but could not be subsequently or could not be prosecuted as well for a sexual assault?
I think the prosecution has the opportunity. They can elect to charge class 4 kidnapping and the particular sexual assault they believe to have occurred. Those can run consecutively if the court so chooses as a matter of discretion, or if there are crime of violence counts attached to those, they can run consecutively as a matter of law.
So even though the statute says kidnapping is a class 2 felony, if the person kidnapped is a victim of a sexual assault pursuant to part 4 of this article, you think the prosecution would have the option whether to charge it as a separate crime and therefore get two separate convictions?
Yes, I think they would. And I think that's consistent with the state opposing counsel's view that the state has the authority to describe proscribed conduct. And so that doesn't step on the hands of the state. In that sense, the prosecution, the executive branch, has the opportunity, discretion to choose what offense is actually being committed and how to prosecute it. In that context, that may be their theory or how they want to approach it. But they're not required. I don't believe the legislative branch can dictate to the prosecution that they must prosecute in a certain way and that only a certain conviction must be obtained in a certain way, given certain facts or circumstances. It depends on which statute they actually proceed under and charge and proceed with prosecute. If the court has no further questions, we would ask the court to vacate the sexual assault convictions at issue.
Thank you. I thank both attorneys for your argument. The case will be submitted on the briefs.